fun. I've got to learn how to put something on the background, though.
Yeah, it's in your options. It's in your options. But hey, welcome to the human occurrence and welcome to space. You know, it's the pleasure to have you on the show. You know, you're my actual first official guest. So, and you know, you're sought after.
I'm so honoured, Brent. I'm so honoured. You are just acting like a bloody TV host.
it's natural to me now, you know. I was actually on the radio this week, funny enough.
Were you?
Yeah, 99.9. It was an experience going into a studio.
What did you talk about?
Well, it definitely wasn't death. Without a doubt, it wasn't death. Now they got me on because they wanted to interview like Byron Bay Ranger and the company and all that kind of stuff. But there was a question where they asked me, "Oh, so what's next on the bucket list for the Ranger?" And I thought, well, here's a good chance to kind of slip in the whole death thing. And I said, well, actually, you know, I'm in the next couple of years, I'm going to be transitioning into the death industry. And fuck, you should have seen the look on their faces, Liz. It's got white. It was a curveball.
Isn't it fascinating people's reaction? Is that light in the way?
Sorry?
That light at the back, is that in the way?
No. You're looking great.
Yep. I'm just on the...
You're not in space, but... you're in Bulara. So if anyone who's going to be watching this, Liz comes from Bulara. That's in Victoria, isn't it? How far out of Victoria is it?
It's 2 hours east of Melbourne.
And right.
Probably more people are familiar with South Gippsland, Murphy North, where a stone's throw from Murphy North. Yeah.
And okay.
It's in the Strathlecky, which is just beautiful, beautiful little spot. And we used to have the wonderful industrial landscape of chimneys and power stations and things that they're slowly getting rid of.
Right. Interesting.
But anyway, stop me. I'm going off.
Hey, so I just want to give a bit of a backstory of how I know you. So I met Liz's beautiful daughter, Dana. It was actually, I forget what airport it was in. But I met her, and I think it would have been like maybe Kuala Lumpur or something. And I did a trip with Dana and my wife, Laura, to Borneo. And that's how I know Liz. So I met Liz. I think you came to Byron. I was actually probably on a phone call in Borneo. And I think from then I soon realized that you were my best friend, not Dana. I love you, Dana, though. I'm sure she'll watch that. But that's a bit of the background. So... what we want to talk about today is, and you know, as you know, is death, dying, and loss. But I want to digest a couple of things around sudden death with you, and you know, your journey through that. So, can you talk into that a bit about your past experiences with it?
Yep, it was 8 years ago now, and my first off, actually, it was 9 years. First of all, my mother, Peggy, she died. I think that was in the, say, September. And she was in her 80s, mid-80s, and she had been ready to go for a while. So she died first off. Then 4 or 5 months later, my husband, who we had been separated for a short time, he had been suffering mental health for a good long while. He took his life, and that was, it was sudden, but I've got to say, me and the two kids, me and Dana and Eamon, had expected it. We'd right. always thought it's a possibility that could happen one day. So yeah. it was still a shock, because it was like it finally happened, and it was like, holy shit, you know. So that threw us a fair bit. Not having experienced suicide in the family before, it was really, I suppose it was really interesting, everyone's reactions to it, because it was like someone So he taking control of the situation at last, and there was a lot of like people reacted differently. Like some people were really angry. I was angry at first, but then it was okay. I can see that you were having a bloody rough time. You've had a rough time for a long time. Who am I to say that you need to stick around, you know?
Yeah.
So there was a whole lot of soul searching and everything that went with that about how I felt about it, how the kids felt about it, and probably trying to protect Mick, my husband, from people's resentment for him doing that, because it was like, well, hang on, no, he's got that right. So around suicide brings a whole lot of other stuff. And then 4 months later, after Mick died, then Emon, who was studying at university, he was home came home on semester break and was out one night partying, and he had a car accident on the way home and was killed. And that was totally unexpected, totally to shock through us, through the community, through everyone. Yeah. Everyone who had sort of bandied around us after Mick had died to help us through, you know, that death.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like, oh my God, you know, it just blew everyone totally away and blew us away. And that was when I think that's when I went into PTSD, post-traumatic disorder, I was diagnosed with, because I completely went into a fog. And I remember walking around in a bit of a daze and thinking, shit, I've got to pay this bill. And it would take me all day to get my act together, to just phone this, you know, utility. Or organise myself. I could not. My mind completely went. So it was like thoughts and everything just went. So that was a real foggy period for probably a good 12 months or more. And I couldn't even cook. Like people dropped around meals and stuff. I couldn't even get my act together I would have to think through the process of how to cook a meal all day.
Yeah.
So it was like all thinking went out. And I used to think, oh my God, you know, like there was expectation to get back to work and that, because I was a casual worker at that time. And because I wasn't having any income, and then I ended up having to go on sickness benefits and stuff because I just couldn't operate. And I looked at other people in other countries. Like a friend said, you know, how somewhere overseas anyway. And they would just batten down for 6 months, not see anyone. People would bring around food and people would clean the house, and you weren't allowed to go out into any society. You wouldn't have TV, no communications whatsoever. You just zoned in into yourself.
Right.
And that's
right.
All I wanted to do. All I wanted to do. People would say, oh, you know, like some other people who I wasn't close to would say, I must come up and have a cup of tea. And I thought, must you? I didn't want to. I didn't want to see any bugger.
Yeah. And that's normal.
Absolutely. But, you know, you just want to batten down, crawl into a cave and hide and cuddle yourself for, you know, 6 months or more. That was all I wanted to do. And I thought, bloody hell, you know, in Western society, we don't do this death stuff very well, where we have no idea or no idea how it affects you and how you're meant to still operate within a job. And
it's very quick, right? It's super quick. And I think with, you know, what we're dealing with in the country at the moment is that there's just absolutely no substance with death or culture. You know, I did a post the other day about death and sorry business, about how the indigenous do death and grief. And like you said, how you kind of want to like bunker down in your home and have that time to grieve and process. You know, there's so many cultures throughout the world that actually do that, where they incorporate ceremony. That's all right. What's that?
I'm trying to turn my phone off and I pressed the wrong button. I'm a technological wizard, as you can see. Okay. It's good.
But yeah, no, I think you know, bunkering down and honoring your time is so goddamn important, you know, because I think from what I've learned from sudden death, because I had a friend in the community that took his life, but it wasn't a family of origin. So that's a completely different story. But sudden death takes a real sledgehammer to your nervous system. And I think that, you know, you can go into fight or flight, but I think it really depends on your familiarity with death, what sort of death it is, and how that will kind of play out. And I could imagine that, you know, from the two different sudden deaths that you've had, from Emon maybe was more of an impact of the shock, right? Would I be right there? Or
yep, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was unexpected.
And sorry, what was your ex-husband's name?
Mick,
that's right. Mick. Yeah. So Mick, you kind of had like a sense of that, you know, that the depression was maybe playing a part of it, and you could kind of sense that was coming. But with Emon, that would have been...
it was one out of the left field, totally. Yeah.
And
totally.
I was talking to my grandmother the other day, and I was talking to her about, because she's obviously lost, you know, when Mum died, and it's such an adjustment to be losing a child. It's just something that I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be so obviously so painful, but such a shock. Mm. You know, such a shock. Mm.
Yeah, it is.
You know, but there's, I guess there's lots of, from my experience with death, it's, you know, I kind of felt like when Mum died for me, like I got punched in the face and then like a sack of jewels chucked at my chest, and I'm like kind of slowly opening up these gifts that come with death. What would some of those gifts would be for you, you know, through your grief journey and all that, like if you were to look back on, you know, what you went through and where you're at now, is there any gifts that would come to your mind that
I reckon it's the gift of slowing right down and looking and listening to people when they speak to you, because I was always rush, miss, go, you know, doing a million things and listening but not really listening to people.
Yeah, it's like and a presence.
It's pulled, because it pulls you right back into this core kind of situation where you are so close to your emotions, your soul's bare, and you're so in tune with emotion, every single emotion. And you're so vulnerable, but it's a really nice feeling too, in that, yeah, you're so in tune with yourself. And I didn't want to lose that. And, you know, you lose it at different times, but I go, hang on, nah, I'm going to try and retain this, because my work was working with young homeless youth in a youth refuge. And so I would listen a hell of a lot more and appreciate where they were coming from and what their lives were like and what was happening within their lives and what's actually being more realistic about what you can expect. Because, you know, when you're working with department guidelines and that, you know, we want them to do this, and I'm thinking, listen, that's a load of bullshit. So long as they can get up in the morning and face the day and have a reasonable conversation and adopt some positiveness, but help them work out what are the positives in their lives and just start with little steps. That was more the thing. And I felt like this wiseness and that came down, came with me, that made me look and face things more like I could.
Right.
There was a young girl. Yeah, there was a young girl at the ref who had lost someone, and she was you know, wanting to talk about it and that, and I just zoned right straight into it and just you know, only just said a little bit here and there, but she knew I understood and I could feel the confidence to be able to talk with her about death and stuff and what she'd lost. And whereas a lot of people shy away from that who haven't experienced it and aren't able to go there because they don't feel confident, and that's fair enough because they haven't experienced it. They don't know what they can say or do, and they're scared of saying something that's going to offend you.
Yeah, that's right.
And I, people used to say, I don't know what to say. And I said, you don't have to say nothing. You just don't. And it just takes you into a realm that unless you've really experienced loss and just shock and all that stuff, you don't know. So
I can completely relate to you.
And I
think it's like such a level of comfort when someone else is going through that and you're talking to someone, and I can relate this back to our conversations that we had maybe a couple of weeks ago when we chatted for an hour. And it was just so nurturing to me talking to you about mum and how she passed and all that, because you just fucking get it. You've been there, you know, and I tell a lot of people this, and I've spoken to you about it, but once you know death, you can't unknow it. So it's like you download, from my experience, like you get like an internal download from wherever that comes from, but you get, and then you have, you know, the ability to really tap into your courage and all these other skills that you might have not known that you had prior. And help people with that. And that's like, for me, one of the gifts that has come out of mum dying is these conversations and really, really exploring them. Death's crazy.
It is crazy. And look, there's humor in death. That's the part I really love, because I mean, oh, freaking hell, we do black humor so well. And I think facing death and all that stuff that it comes with brings out the black humour even more. Yeah. Like, I don't know whether it's just a go-to to go, oh, God, lift me out of this crap for a moment, just a moment, give me a laugh, you know. And so there's that clinging on to that little bit of finding a humour in things. And it was a bit like this funny story, I don't know whether I told you, when Mick died, we had a black Kelpie. And she was, you know, 150 million years old. She was very old. And she bloody pegged it the day after he died.
Yeah, pegged it? What do you mean?
And she died, sorry.
Oh, right. I thought she ran away. Like pegged.
No, she died. And we had to took her into the vet, and the vet said, oh, look, you know, and Dana's going, no, you have to do something. I've just lost my dad. And the poor vet's going, oh, Christ, beam me up, Scotty, you know. And she said, look, if you take her home, get her through the night and take her to your other vet tomorrow morning. So we took her into the vet, you know, and we knew by then Dana had the overnight to digest what had to happen. You know, we've got to put her down. It's not fair to her. Yeah. So we put her down and brought her home. So Eamon and I dig a hole out front next to where our other dog had been buried. And he digs this frigging huge hole anyway, and it's a big, big hole. We've got poor old, what was her name I just said? The dog? She's lying in a black bag next to this hole. And then we had to get the gas, our gas man came to replace the gas. And he's coming up the drive and he sees this big pile of dirt and this hole, and he's like, oh, God, he had this look of horror on his face. And I said, Dave, it's okay. It's not Mick's hole. We're not burying him in the front yard.
Yeah, I think
he was just like, oh, God, Liz. Oh, God, no. And, you know, there was those sort of things. And there was a few funny things because our neighbour Chris, he's gorgeous. He was good mates with Mick, and he said, I want to build his coffin. And we used to mill cypress timbers. And so we had a heap of wood up the back. And so he built his coffin. And the funeral director we had, he was just beautiful, beautiful lad, Mark. Right. And I said, Mark, I want to, you know, we've got our coffin sorted and that. And he said, yep, no worries. I said, look, Mick's body was at the funeral directors at Warrigal, and I said, look, how do we organise this? And he said, look, I can come and collect it, or you can bring it down, whatever you like. Now, Mick had his old van at our place, which was this yellow, yucky yellow, mustard-coloured, you know, van. And I'd always wanted to paint flowers on it, you know, and make it a little hippie van. And he was like, no, get away, you know, not doing that. And I thought, well, Buggy, you're dead now. You can't stop me. When Chris brought the coffin over and I lined it with calico and all that, and I'm out in the shed doing all this banging and tapping and stuff, and I thought, stuff it, I'm going to paint this bloody van, because next morning I was going to drive the coffin down in the back of the van to Warrigal.
Right.
I got out all these paints and I started painting all these big flowers, and I was just going nuts on this van. And the kids are looking through the window and they thought I'd gone mad. They said, shit, Mum's gone
lost
mad.
It. Mum's lost it.
I was there till 10 o'clock painting these flowers. I was just determined. I was like, nah, I'm doing this. And I'm going to carry him down, or carry his coffin down with this painted van. Well, bugger me, that night was a really heavy dew and all the paint ran.
Oh, right.
I got up in the morning and it looked like I'd run through, it hit a herd of wombats. It was just atrocious. There was bloody blood-like drips of orange and red all down the sides of the van. I was like, oh, no. So I had to try and scrub it all and make it better. But I'll never forget driving this coffin, loading the coffin in the back of the van, and the whole thing was just so bloody quirky, and driving down the freeway and people going past looking at the van and looking at the painting. And I thought, you've got no idea what I got in here, mate, you know.
I can relate to you there, because Dad and I drove Mum to the crematorium and, you know, we made the coffin and painted it. But, you know, by you painting, you know, the van and all that, that would have been such a, you know, good release and a part of
it
your
was.
Process. And like for me, it was just like, at the time it was so confronting, but I couldn't imagine anyone else doing it. That's why I wanted to build it and paint it. You know, all our family painted it, Amy and Kylie and Dad. And it was just such a good process to kind move through it.
Yeah, because you've got to get in touch with it. Because when I think about, you know, I was thinking about how, you know, the Irish would wash the body, be with them for a week, and it was so cold over there they could afford to have the body in the house for a week because it'd be freezing, so they're not going to blow up from the heat at all. But, you know, and people could visit that person and sit with them, and you know, it's just more real, because it's our, you know, the way we do it in you know, modern society, where you just bloody give it over, you contract out that whole process of death to a mob who, they look after the body, they prepare the body, they bury the body, you know, and we just go and visit and go, oh yeah, and we're okay, you do some music and you do the photos for the service, but everything else is contracted out. And it's you can't contract out that stuff.
Taking your power back with that process and
yeah, exactly.
And knowing your options. It's really cool that you did all that, because a lot of people don't know their options around that time.
No, and I think that was partly because I'd experienced it with Mum's death.
Right.
And where I just went through the process with my family and that. And it was done a little bit different, but it sort of opened up my eyes to it. And then Mark, I'll give him a hell of a lot of credit, because he put suggestions there. He said, you can do this. And he involved the kids in it. Like we were just sitting around the kitchen table. And he said, and Eamon came up with the suggestion for Mick's coffin. Oh, look, I'd really like to enable people to write on the coffin what they felt about Mick and what he had done, because you could give Mick a compliment and he'd never take it on. He'd never take on any praise. He had a very low self-belief in himself. And so Eamon said, we can write, but it'd be really good to write on the coffin and write all those good things and give people the opportunity to say what they wanted to say.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow. And it just opened it up. And it was a fabulous, it was a beautiful thing at the service that we did at the graveside. We just had a graveside service and did all the music and whatnot. And yeah, it was beautiful. So that was a really, and that pulled people out of the, say the group who, and we just filed up and wrote on the coffin what he meant, you know, what they wanted to say to him. And that put them in direct contact with him in the coffin, you know. So yeah, they came close to it and touched it and, yeah, just made that contact with him. Mm. Whereas if you just watch from afar, you know, the coffin going down into the graveside, you're an observer. You're not so involved with it. And and that really helped. And then with Eamon, we took it a bit further because it was such a shock and I was so concerned about a lot of his friends. I said, right, can we bring him home before the night before the funeral and have him here? I think we did that with Mick too, actually. We did do that with Mick. Yeah, we brought him home and he left from here because we wanted him at home, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he left, yeah. So, and the same thing with Eamon, but we had a gathering that night with all his friends and stuff. And gave them time to just sit with him and play music and have a few drinks and cry and whatever. But I could see it was really, really, really important for everyone, for all of us. It was good.
Yeah.
And I think when I think of Dana, she just reminded me of, when Fatsy, our first golden retriever and her first dog that she grew up with died.
Yeah.
Now she lives upstairs in the house in the mezzanine.
I've seen it.
And bugger me dead when Fatsy died, we brought him home in the bag and she said, Mum, I want him out of the bag and I want to take him up to my room and have him with me. And I said, and this was middle of summer, and I said, hang on, for how long? And we'd had to carry him and had him out on the front lawn with her. She slept with him on the lawn first of all when we got him home that night. She didn't. So she slept in a sleeping bag out in the lawn with him, middle of summer. Then she wanted him upstairs with her in the bedroom. And I'm like, hang on, nah. He's going to stink the house out and I'll never get him down again. She'll want to keep him there forever, you know?
Yeah.
But it kind of showed how important it is for people to spend time with them, you know, before you say goodbye to them. That being with them, whether it be dog or person, is so important.
And that really it brings a lot of, like, you know, a lot of beauty into the moment. I can kind of reflect, and when Mum was passing, it was really confronting seeing her body slowly shut down. But to me, you know, what I felt was this such a level of beauty through the presence that it brought to the moment, and how connected and together our family was through that process, that magic was happening, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it's, you know, I think it's the most healthiest way to actually process it is to actually be able to lie with someone who's passed you know, give that space and see the magic work there. It can be confronting, you know, like I tell some people about it and they're just like, you are fucking wild. What are you talking about? The fuck are you talking about? That is wild. But like we've already spoken about, like here in Australia is, you know, you're with someone that's sick and then whack, you're at the funeral and then whack, you're at the wake. And then by the time you know it, your body's trying to keep up and your mind, and you're trying to work out like what the hell just happened. You know, there's a reason why there's so much culture in other countries that do these practices, you know. And they do death and grief so well.
They give themselves time. They give themselves time, and that's where rituals are really good. In that, like, I grew up with the Catholic religion and I certainly don't support it any, you know, I gave it up when I was about a teenager, but there's rituals in that you can take comfort from, like, you know, they have the funeral, they have the swinging of that smelly vase thing on chains that they'd light with, it has olive, I I think it's rosemary? I think it's rosemary, yeah. So, but it's beautiful smell. And as soon as I hear smell that smell, I go back to that time.
Yeah, yeah.
And those just those little sounds and just that ritual. So I can see it makes you appreciate what those rituals must, how helpful they must be for cultures where they do death properly and drag it out. Because and to me, it's like, oh God, when's it ever going to stop? But you went in by lengthening that whole process, you give every opportunity along the way to express emotion. Mm. Whereas we do it quick, bang, bang, 2 weeks off work, back at it. Yep. Okay. 6 months, 12 months. You should be right. You know, should be over it. What's a go? Yeah. And then, because I had multiple, like there was mum, 4 months later, Mick, 4 months later, Eamon, and then 4 months later, Dad. And all the buggers just said, see you later, we're out of here. And it was like, holy moly. And I used to think, and I'd be thinking about Eamon, and then I'd think, oh, but I better think about Mick. And then, oh, what about mum and dad? I'm not giving them any time to grow. And it's like, holy shit, how do I,
I guess the most important person in this process is yourself.
Yeah.
You know, looking after you, making sure your cup's full. And, when you're discussing, you know, ritual and ceremony, that kind of has like amplified in my life now because, you know, I have a daily practice, you know, where I'll like create space and then set an intention for just creating stillness within me. And, I tell a lot of my friends about that. And it unfortunately, it took a death for me to actually really go there and honor myself like that. But ceremony is so powerful in whatever form you want to look at it, you know, whether it's a daily practice or it's at a wedding, a funeral, you know, you're honoring the elements, whatever it is, there's so much power in ceremony. And, you know, I'm a big believer that, you know, a good ceremony is worth about 12 months therapy, you know, and I'm a big one for therapy. You know, I see a therapist every fortnight. Without my therapist, I'd be slamming my head against his desk.
Oh, look, I had a couple of good few years. I think I had 2 or 3 years of a good psychologist, and she was brutally. She didn't let me get away with anything. You know, you have to have, and people assume because you're, you know, working with people and you do a bit of informal counselling and stuff, you've got it together, but you're just better at hiding shit, and you need a brutal little bugger that's going to cut through all that. And oh my God, she was ruthless, but she was so good. And also there was one other thing that happened that is worth, that she made me, that really got me thinking. When Eamon died, there were so many processes where you've got to call different, like I had to call the university and tell them, I had to call this bugger and tell them, tell so many people. I couldn't. Now, at that time, I didn't understand Facebook and how it was linked with phone and all that. Right. And I thought he was on a phone plan, and I thought if I stopped his phone plan, he would then no longer have Facebook and we wouldn't be able to talk, you know, or see all this stuff. And so I just kept paying it for 6 months because – and there was also, I just could not make another call to say, my son has been killed, he's died, you know. It was just so hard. So anyway, finally, at the end of the 6 months, I rang Telstra to say what had happened, that he's died and I have to, oh, yes, madam, yes, we'll close it. They closed the account, supposedly. Then 3 months or a month later, I get another account for $90 or whatever. I think, listen, you buggers, because I was on the phone for probably an hour the first time to shut the account down.
Right.
It took an hour of that, and that was arduous enough, and I knew it was going to be hard. And then I get another account, and I think, listen, you buggers, and I was starting to get a bit wild, you know, and I rang and said, listen, it was, no, madam, you will have to pay that bill. I said, I'm not paying you one red cent, sweetheart. I was getting pretty antsy by then. I said, I spent an hour. Anyway, no, you'll have to pay the bill. And I spoke to a supervisor. They sorted it. So then that's finished. That was another hour gone, wasted talking to bloody Telstra.
Yeah.
So then another month went by and I got another account. Lizzie hit the roof and I was in my room, and it's a double bricked, it was a part of the house that was a double brick garage converted into a home. And I lost it. And she says, oh, sorry, madam, you will have to pay this bill. I said, I'm not paying the bill. Put me on to your supervisor, please. And the supervisor said, yeah, da, da, da. And then would put me back to the other one. You will still have to pay the bill. I'm not paying you one effing red cent by then. And then they put, oh, we'll have to put you through to this other, I don't know, it was death department or something. You know, you talk about people have died and try and sort out the account. Put me through the death department. 2 hours later, they're trying to counsel me. I'm going absolutely spastic, roaring. I've never shouted as loud. I'm screaming at this phone saying, I am not paying you my phone. Red cent. And the phone, he has not used it. He's been dead for 6 months, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
It's in his top drawer. No one touches it. You know, I was just going mad. And I screamed and yelled and ranted and raved. And I went to the psychologist and she said, well, look, Lizzie, people pay hundreds of dollars to go to a weekend, you know, a weekend workshop to let everything out. And you did it and you got it paid. You didn't have to pay anything. You didn't have to pay a cent. And let out every by sounds of what you said. You let out any residual anger or anything there. It all went. And I just thank God it was two. It's a, you know, double garage that it was no one could hear me. Oh my God! I just let it rip. That's it was great. Amazing. It was great when I think of it, and I thought, what a great way of looking at that. Because yeah, Telstra did that for me. So thank you, Telstra.
Good on Telstra, hey. I'm not with Telstra, but
Never been with them ever since.
Oh. they got cut from that moment.
Absolutely.
Hey,
see you later.
Does Dana know we're talking today?
No. Oh, she knows we were going to, but not today.
Right. And how's Dana?
She's pretty good. She's taken a long time to, you know, get to a point where she can operate and be able to not be just reacting to the grief and loss and all that. Mm. She's got to a point where at first she did a lot of things for Eamon. She was doing things to remember him by, to honour him. And she's now got to a point where I don't need to do that anymore. I'm going to do things for me that I really want to do, you know?
Yeah.
She's had to deal with heaps of anxiety stuff, like after they died, and I think she'd be okay with me talking about this. She buried herself in study. And she's a pretty intelligent kid and she was able to do that. So she pretty much lost herself in her study. And when she went to uni, she just buried into study again. But it brought back all those memories of when she lost people.
Yeah.
So it created this anxiety and panic attacks and stuff. And she struggled for about 6 months. And she wasn't confident enough at that time to seek help within the university and look for, you know, I'd suggest it to her, but she just, wasn't ready yet to do any of that.
Yeah.
And so she ended up leaving and traveling and just working and doing things like that. So then, that's right, she got into yoga and I thought, well, this is really going to help. So she did a diploma in yoga and that.
And she's awesome at it. She's awesome at yoga. Wasn't she doing She was doing some sort of retreats and also had a little gig happening at your house.
Yeah, she's had a few good gigs at home and they were great.
Your house is amazing.
Yeah. It's our little heaven.
Isn't it? It's so homely. When I went, when we came there, I think it was, I think Laura was about to, pretty sure she was crowning.
She was pretty,
she was pretty big.
She wasn't quite crowning, but she was pretty big.
I remember looking back on the photos and going, wow, I was pretty pudgy. And then, Laura was, you know, not pudgy, but just big. She's, you know.
Oh, she would look beautiful. She was beautiful, but she was big. She was ready to get that baby out, you know.
I remember just going through the house and having so much feel to it and so much character and so much, like, just so many memories. You can just feel memories there, you know. And, yeah, I need to come back. I'd love to come back. It's a pity, you know.
You'll have to.
Happening in, you know, what's happening in Victoria at the moment. And
yeah, well, that's it. Yeah. Who knows when you'll be able to come down.
But you're saying that you're pretty fortunate that you're not in the middle of it all, right?
I know. Well, Dana's down in Thornbury. She's in Melbourne.
Thornbury's in Melbourne, like in the middle.
Yeah. So she's in lockdown.
Oh, right. Okay.
And she's got Louie with her, the golden retriever. So we got Louie when Emon died. She said, "Mom, I just need a dog I can cuddle. I need something to love." So, oh, how could you not, bloody, you know? So we got Louie, and he's been the best thing for her. Like, he gets her out there, and she said, "I think he loves people more than other dogs, Mum." And probably she takes him for walks, and he just smiles as soon as someone comes towards him. He's got a big smile on his face, ready to greet them, and he's the greatest.
Some dogs love humans more than actual dogs. They're actually, you know, some dogs are humans.
Yeah. Oh, he is. He's hilarious. So he's her saviour. And also for the others in the house, it's a share house and three other women, and they're great. So they're all taking it in turns on taking Louis out for walks, and he gives them the balance to get him out, you know, like she's studying her art and stuff, art and design. And it's the best thing because she's learning to express herself. And that was another thing I wanted to talk a little bit about. Because I've got an art background, I kind of, you're a little bit opportunistic as an artist, and any issues and things that are affecting you, you can express. And I've always kind of honed in on grief stuff with my artwork, and that was even when I was studying. Or 10 years later, with this death experiences, I just started doing artwork and pouring it all into that. And I was making these fabric out of old blankets, hearts, little hearts. And I'd stuff them, and then I'd slash them, and then I'd slash the blanket, and then I would stitch them up again. And I'd stitch them with a little bit of red thread as well. And then I did this, I can't remember what it's called, but it's when you put another material into it, like a wool material. And so you stab it, and it's a little tool that has a tiny little hook, and it embeds that thread into the material you're stabbing. And so I'm stabbing this stuff. And that was another part of this lovely, you know, that emotion of resentment and anger. You bastard, you died, you're going to bloody kill you, you know, you're already dead. But anyway, and I'm stabbing away with this thread, and I made all these hearts. And then there was other people who had, you know, my neighbour, she lost her husband, and I took a heart to her and gave it to her, and she just looked at it and cried and put it inside her shirt, you know, in her bra against her heart.
That's beautiful.
And it was just, and so I started making all these hearts, but then I was going to make a huge big pile of them in a gallery, and people would come to the exhibition and they could take one, you know. And I haven't finished it. I've got a bag full of hearts, but my thumb started getting like RSI, and I was thinking, oh shit, you know, from stuffing the wool in.
You need labor to come in and help you to make these hearts. But that was for you, like, so that for you was just a healthy expression of moving your grief or whatever you're going through at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a really good, I started seeing the whole art, kind of art therapy, but art, you know, using art as a therapy to express, you know, your emotions and everything, and conceptualizing it, you know, and putting it into some sort of object that people could relate to. And and that's where I guess when you're able to express yourself in one form or another, I find that extremely helpful. Like I remember my psychologist saying, you need to draw every day, but I couldn't because it was so freaking painful. Like I would draw stuff and it was just, you know, I used to draw realistic, and then I was able to start drawing just these interesting little figures and forms. So it's kind of taken me completely, it's projected me into a whole different way of drawing, which is really good. And I really like, but it is, I still find it incredibly painful. I could almost, if I put on, you know, someone like bloody Tom Waits or Leonard Cohen, I'd be there howling and drawing, you know. I'd have me, if I did some charcoals, and I'm meant to be working on some now, and I've started, but holy God, it is just extremely painful. And that's still after 8 years, because it makes you confront your emotions while you're drawing, you know. And I remember doing one drawing, of doing a drawing at the moment of Emon, where he was doing flips and everything on a trampoline. And these figures, they're incredible. They were like, their shots were just grabbing each shape and form he was doing on the tramp. And there was one where he was absolutely just flailing, kind of. There was this moment of just total abandon or abandonment. And it was like, wow, did you look like that when you were going through the air throwing about in the car? That's all I could think of. That's what I related it to. And I did that, I did a charcoal of it, and I had it up in Dana's room, and she came home and she said, oh my God, Mum. And I said, she said, that just reminds me of Emon around in the car. And I went, I'm glad you saw that, because that's what I felt. And I wasn't sure whether I was just seeing it and it wasn't really there. It was just me imagining it. But she saw it, you know, straight away. And I thought, okay, well, that's good, because if you're going to do a drawing, you want it to have some impact. So, you know, I was kind of happy with that.
Yeah, that's powerful. That's really powerful.
It is. Yeah.
Look, before we wrap it up, if you could, and this is going to be a tough, might not be a tough question, but if you could give any advice to someone who is going through sudden death and something that you've gone through, you know, what would that be? And it doesn't have to be, you know, one line or anything like that.
I think the most helpful thing is, don't have any expectations on yourself. Throw them out the window, because whatever you do is okay for you, and people might raise their eyebrows or whatever. It's, you just do what is right for you, because I did spend a bit of time trying to do what was right for everyone else. And to some degree, it was a distraction for me. I'm pretty good at distracting myself from wanting to feel anything. And so I would worry about everyone else. And it was a great method of not having to worry about my own stuff. I just think stop and give yourself time and just, you know, I mean, there will be time when you just run around like a hairy goat, because that's what you do to bloody survive.
And love that analogy. Survive.
Hey?
Hairy goat. I love that analogy. I saw it straight away. Like, shit, there's that hair.
Oh, God. Yeah. So I think, whatever you do, it's just, I think you just got to go easy on yourself, totally easy on yourself, and just fuck everything. You know, you've just got to sit with it. Do whatever you do, but don't put any expectations on yourself. You got to give yourself time, because if you don't, if you pretend it's not there, it's going to bite you on the ass sometime or other, whether it be in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years.
That's right.
So you might as well deal with the bugger deal with the monster while you deal while it's there,
yeah.
And also capitalize on when on people giving you some space, because they'll only give it to you for so long.
Mm.
So make the most of it while you've got it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Hey Liz, thank you so much for sharing. Before we wrap it up, you haven't met Zevi yet, have you?
Who?
Zev.
Dev.
Zev. No, I want to get him and show you, because he's probably the cutest kid walking the planet. But I'm pretty biased there. So give me 2 seconds and I'll just get him.
Okay, I would love to see him.